This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mary Carr, is best known for her memoir, The Liars Club, which was on the bestseller list for over a year. It was about growing up in a small town in Texas with a mother who had a psychotic break and often behaved monstrously. Carr's new memoir, Lit, is in part about how Carr almost became what she feared most, crazy and monstrous, like her mother. Lit describes her early years as a writer, wife, and mother. Her marriage was falling apart, and her drinking interfered with being a good parent. Actually, Carr's drinking was interfering with just about everything. To stop, she went to support groups where people urged her to seek a higher power. She found one, and much to her surprise, she became a committed Catholic. Carr is a professor of literature at Syracuse University. Mary Carr, welcome back to Fresh Air. There's a short passage from the opening chapter of Lit that I'd like you to read for us. And this chapter is actually a letter to your son, who's how old now?
23.
All right.
However long I've been granted sobriety, however many hours I logged in therapist offices in the confessional, I've still managed to hurt you. And not just with the divorce when you were five, with its attendant shouting matches and slammed doors. Just as my mother vanished from my young life into a madhouse, so did I vanish when you were a toddler. Having spent much of my life trying to plumb her psychic mysteries, I now find myself occupying her chair as plummy, and believe me, it's a discomforting sensation.
It's Mary Carr reading from her new memoir, Lit, and your reference to being a plummy is that your son had asked you to find a video, a family video, that you had made of your mother talking to you and telling you her version of her psychotic break. And he wanted that video for a documentary class that he's making. Apparently, he's kind of wedded to his own video camera. So would you tell a story of this video and of your mother's psychotic break?
Oh, boy, Terry, you really know how to start off.
Yeah, let's start with the cheerful stuff.
I guess it was before I was in school. My mother dragged all our toys out into the backyard and threatened to kill us with a butcher knife, and then us being my sister and I. Then she was, like, hallucinating that she had killed us, and there was blood all over the room, and she called the family doctor. When you do this in a small Texas backwater, I mean, people show up pretty fast. There were firemen and doctors and ambulances and police. So it was a big traumatic moment. And then she checked into what we called a mental Marriott. They put her inpatient for a while, not surprisingly. So that scene opens The Liars Club. And is a kind of pivotal traumatic scene. It's definitely a nadir in my family history. It's, you know, I've said it a million times. My family was not always that chaotic or that bad, but it was a very bad time for us.
So what was it like for you playing that video back? How long had it been since you had watched it?
Oh, I probably had never watched it, would be my guess. We decided when I was cleaning out her house to move her closer to my sister, we decided to go through a bunch of family albums so she could name people we'd never met because she was an only child and had very little family, and she could. So I was doing a videotape of that, and in the midst of that, I asked her about that night that she threatened to kill us and what it was like. And then flash forward however many years, 45 years, and there's my 22-year-old son in a documentary class who is dredged up this video of my mother talking about this scene, and he said to me, I can't believe how strange it was. And I said, well, honey, you know that story. It's family legend that night. It's not like it was a big secret. And he said, yeah, but she told it like it happened to somebody else. I mean, that's really crazy. Like, you know, he always saw his grandmother as just this funny old white-haired lady, but he never really got the ways she could have been dangerous. Even though she showed him a pistol in her purse when he was 8 years old, which he reported to me. It was such a tattletale. So he's doing this, and having never read any of my books, a conscious decision on his part, he read the opening description of The Liars Club. So, you know, my mother had this complicated, beautiful, crazy mother that she painted. And I have this complicated, crazy mother that I write about. And now my kid has this complicated, crazy mother, i.e. me, and he's got footage.
So this must have gotten you thinking, because it certainly got me thinking about the difference between a videotaped episode and an episode remembered through writing. Now, granted, what your mother was telling you on videotape is something she remembered, and who knows how accurately she's remembering her own motivations and her own memory.
Right, she was psychotic, and she is, you know, once she told me she'd been drunk for a week, and once she told me she hadn't had a drink, so who knows?
Mm-hmm,
who knows?
Mm-hmm. But have you been thinking about the difference between, like, video and memoir?
Oh, absolutely. I think what memoir gives, and I think one reason there's been a renaissance of interest in the form, is it gives the inner life of the participants. A video camera can't capture my mother's history in an eye blink. It's very reductive. You know, we live and die by these visual images as though they're fact. In fact, they don't tell what anyone's motivation was or what they were thinking. I mean, my mother tells this story as though killing us were a very benevolent thing. Like she says, I see these precious little girls, and I think how hard it is to be a woman, and they're treated so badly. So I just thought I'd kill you. I mean, it's like she's saying, I thought, you know, I'd give you a haircut.
She thought that she'd kill you before the world damaged you.
Right, right. And, you know, and that's what my son found so peculiar was her demeanor, that she was so blithe about it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mary Carr, and she's just written her third memoir. It's called Lit. It's a follow-up to her first two memoirs, Liar's Club and Cherry. One of the things I'm interested in, you talk about money a little bit in the book, because your husband, Warren, is that his real name?
That's not his real name.
It's not his real name.
I offered my ex-husband, I said, you can either vet these pages or I can give you a pseudonym, and he said, I prefer the pseudonym, which I don't blame him, you know.
Why was that the choice, vet the pages or pseudonym?
He's just a circumspect person. He's a WASP, for goodness sake. I just wouldn't want to parade. You know, you're writing about your divorce is never a pretty, it's never a pretty story. And I just wanted to give him the chance to be anonymous, which I, knowing him, I presumed he would take. And indeed he did. So,
right. Okay. Well, you know, you describe it in the book how, like, you're from this real kind of hardscrabble kind of background, and he was from a very prosperous family. You went to meet the family, and they had this mansion that was named.
It had a name to it, like a baronial-sounding name, and it was right next to the Hitchcock estate out on Long Island. They had polo ponies, you know, and tennis courts, and we passed through these wide gates, and I said to my then boyfriend, is this a subdivision? And he said, no, this is my house.
So you had really different views of money. Like, your idea was, like, we need money. What do we need to do to get it? And his idea was more like, I never, ever want to be in the position where I have to ask my parents for money.
Right.
And you couldn't really understand that. Like, why not? If they have the money, why not?
You know, I just, it was like, if you had lowered me, you know, onto an island with the peace-loving Tassadae, I would have fit in better than I did with those WASPs. But boy, did they look appealing to me, Terry. They just look like such a solution, those people. I remember getting there, and everything's so organized. And at one point, I remember at this long, glossy table with maids, and there's a cook in the kitchen and a pantry big as a bowling alley. And at one point, we run out of asparagus, and the maid is sent to fetch more. And you can hear the cook bellow, tell him if he ate like a normal man, it would have been enough asparagus. No one's face alters a whisker. I'm looking around the room, and it's like this icy fog rolls across the table. And I think, my Lord, these people have found the solution. This is it. I mean, this is the anti-venom to the snake bite of who I am, is the ability to ignore what's happening.
Now, you went to couples therapy while you were married and having trouble in the marriage. And I'm interested in that in the sense that as a memoirist, you are always telling your point of view of the story. And in couples therapy, you're hearing like the other person's point of view. You're hearing their version of the story. And I'm wondering if that was kind of revelatory to you in any way to hear in this kind of theoretically neutral setting of the therapist's office, your husband's version of your story.
Oh, I don't think I was able to actually hear my husband's version. I mean, I think, you know, I was drinking to avoid hearing my husband's version. I was making so much noise. One interesting thing about that therapist was I sent her the chapters about the marriage. Even though my ex-husband didn't want to look at them, I wanted her to just see if they seemed fair or, you know, another person who knows him, I sent the pages to. So I think I made it pretty clear that I was, you know, I had my fingers in my ears and I was going, no. You know, I was, the book is about lit because it's about all the ways I lit up or lit out, first with reading and books. I mean, booksellers and librarians and shrinks and teachers saved my life. And then with liquor. And so I went to couples therapy, but my participation in that, I'm sure I didn't hear much.
After you started drinking, you realized eventually that you had a problem. One of the ways you realized that was when you nearly killed yourself in an accident and when you started to think about killing yourself. So you checked yourself into a hospital, you decided to get help, you started going to meetings. And at meetings, you were told to pray and to find faith. And the person telling you this said, you might find sober people who don't pray, but all the happy ones have some kind of regular meditative or spiritual practice. What was your reaction when you were told that?
Oh, I'm a big eye roller. You know, I come from a family of eye rollers. And the degree to which I'm an unlikely religious person, first of all, let me say that talking about spiritual activity to a secular audience is like doing card tricks on the radio. You know, like I'm saying, look, isn't this great? And I know I'm going to sound slightly addled from time to time. So the degree to which I was cynical about prayer, I remember people giving me these one day at a time, these Boy Scout slogans, you know, that like they put on big felt banners like from the Jamboree. And God, I couldn't imagine praying. It was like, I think I say in the book, it was like pointing at a stump and saying, fall in love with that, or pointing at a mannequin and saying, talk to that. It was insane to me. It was beyond crazy. So I thought faith was a feeling. My intellect told me this was insane. The only way I was able to do it was through practice. I think I've mentioned this before with my last book of poems, Sinner's Welcome. Someone challenged me to pray on my knees morning and night every day. And this was after I nearly drove into a piece of concrete. And I've been trying to get sober and not really listening to the ways you're supposed to do it. And somebody said, pray on your knees every day for 30 days and see if you stay sober. And in the morning, say, you know, help me stay sober. And at night, say, thanks for helping me stay sober. And I just saw it as like self-hypnosis or like talking to yourself, talking to some higher self or higher part of yourself.
Remember that video we were talking about that you made of your mother in which she described to you her psychotic break and why she thought about killing you and your sister when you were very
right.
young? Okay, in that video you described her as wearing a florid robe that would suit a Wiccan priestess.
Yeah, she was very into all kinds of voodoo stuff.
Yeah, so I was wondering, like, what are some of the, like, more unusual, like, spiritual practices that she tried on for size when you were young?
Oh, my God. I mean, well, she did yoga in, like, 1962. No one was doing hatha yoga, but my mother was, and breathing exercises you know, she went briefly to the Christian Science Church. She went to theosophy meetings. She, she was very interested in Buddhism for a long time. You know, eventually the Episcopalians got her. I mean, who knew that a group that sort of organized in white and everything would get my mother? But she took instruction. She became Episcopalian. I mean, it was very, very strange to me. But I became Catholic after my nervous breakthrough. I eventually became Catholic, but and I would laugh myself cockeyed if you'd said I was going to become Catholic.
Was your mother's spiritual searching going on when you were young and living with her, or was that later in life?
I would say intermittently. My mother was so capricious. I mean, she was really like a little kid, you know. She might get excited about yoga for like a weekend. It wasn't like, you know, she would embrace anything wholehearted. I mean, she was married 7 times, Terry. You know, she was iffy about everything. She was iffy about us. You know, I told my sister, I said, didn't you feel sort of like, I just did an interview for Paris Review, and the interviewer asked me, was she like a stage mother to your being a writer? I just said, like Mozart's daddy? No. I mean, we were like lizards in a terrarium that, like, every couple of weeks she'd tap the side of the glass to see if we were still alive. She wasn't that interested in us. But
that's a horrible.
It wasn't a great childhood. But my sister agreed, so I, you know. But, you know, my mother, you know, but she also saved me. I mean, she got sober. My mother was sober.
And when did she get sober?
She was in her 60s. It was right
how,
after.
How old were you?
I think it was right after I married. I mean, she fell off the wagon at my rehearsal dinner. I write about it in the book. It's the night we're going to the Ritz-Carlton with all the WASP. My father-in-law has had a tab there since Harvard Law. So it's the Boston Ritz. We're having a rehearsal dinner. I'm lying with my neck arched up in a sink, and I smell marijuana in this beauty salon where I'd taken her to get her hair done. And I think, mother. I think, mother. And sure enough, my mother gets gunched out of her mind with her hairdresser in the alley, smoking pot, gets her hair jacked up like a transvestite. Really, it looked like a big topiary. And then at the actual dinner, says to my father-in-law that she'll paint him in the nude and fix anything he needed fixed. I mean, this is my mother fell off the wagon at my rehearsal dinner. So shortly after that, she got sober and was sober until she died, almost 80, so more than 20 years. So I was in my early 30s, and it's interesting. It's almost like she got sober right about the time my drinking picked up. I say it's almost like our genetic code owed the universe some really wretched alcoholic, and I stepped into the slot as she left it.
I want to quote something that you write in your book that I think relates to what you were saying about the pain and fear that you grew up with. You write, when you've been hurt enough as a kid, it's like having a trick knee. Most of your life, you can function like an adult. But add in the right proportions of sleeplessness and stress and grief, and the hurt, defeated self can bloom into place.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I write about, and when, you know, for me, one of the moments of revelation, for me, evidence of God, which, by the way, you know, my editors took out a lot of evidence for God because I sounded, and they were right, you know, I think I sounded like, you know, one of those, you know, send me a dollar and put your hand on the TV screen and I'll heal you. I think I did sound a little nuts a couple of places. But when I was doing the Jesuit exercises, the Ignatian exercises, praying to see my sinfulness in all its ugliness, part of that, during that time, during Lent, when I was praying about that, I was moving my mother and cleaning out the house where I grew up. And then she blew up at me. Obviously, she was 70-some years. She was stressed and scared. And I launched into her. Boy, and I was her for a minute. You know, I bloomed into this fire-breathing lunatic. And it was horrifying to me. It was horrifying. And, you know, I apologized to her. She was fine about it. But really, it was just really grotesque and awful. And I had been given by my spiritual director, who's this Franciscan nun, these three passages in the Bible. And I open up my mother's childhood Bible. And the first one I find is marked. It's Psalm 51. And it's marked in blue chalk. It's her little, she had this since 1927, she had this thing. And the second one is also marked. And there are no other marks in the Bible. But for me, a coincidence like that would just be evidence that there is a force for grace, a force for good, that is very specifically interested in me. And if I open myself or I say to myself at each moment, you know, where is the good in this? Where is the God in this? But it's hard to do that. I would rather, I don't know why it's so hard to do.
Because it's hard to do?
I think because my big smart brain wants to think that it runs everything. I mean, honestly, that's what it, even though I know that when I pray and I try to live in this kind of surrendered, more present state, everything is better.
Each chapter starts with a poem or an excerpt of a poem.
Right.
And some of the poetry that you've chosen wonderful poems to excerpt, and some of them are really bleak. And for example, I offer this one by Alan Dugan. It's an excerpt of his poem, or maybe it's the whole poem. I'm not sure which, but it's called "Love Song I and
It's
Thou."
It's an excerpt.
So this song is basically about needing a partner for self-destruction. It goes, "This is hell, but I planned it. I sought it, I nailed it, and I will live in it until it kills me. I can nail my left palm to the left-hand cross piece, but I can't do everything myself. I need a hand to nail the right, a help, a love, a you, a wife." What's the relevance of that poem to your life? Like, who are you in this poem?
You know what's interesting? Well, I'm the speaker, of course, but you know what's interesting? Well, I'd like to be God, but I'm not. But and it's the poem's called "I and Thou," of course, after Martin Buber's great, in which the thou is God, right? And so he's speaking both to his wife and to God. But I can't believe you think that's bleak. It seems to me accurate. I mean, what hell do we occupy that we don't construct? You know, what idea about yourself have you ever had and pursued with a vengeance that was ill-fitting for you and that you've railed against? I didn't want to stop drinking. I didn't quit drinking because I wanted to stop drinking. I wanted to keep drinking and, you know, doing other things. I want to do all these things that aren't particularly good for me. My hells are pretty much self-constructed. Don't you think? I mean, don't you think everybody's are, sort of? I mean, the whole idea of hubris and in Greek tragedy, thinking you're as big as the gods, that's the source of all tragedy. And to me, that's the nature of needing help to crucify yourself. Yes.
I'm not sure I agree with what you said, because I think a lot of hell is external in the world and not a function of your own, you know, of your own will or your own construction. Although I do think that the frame of mind you take to that hell can affect how you experience it and survive it.
You know why I put all those quotes in, Terry?
Why?
Because I was so cut off from books, and I thought I was very afraid. I'm very afraid of failing. You know, I kept Samuel Beckett's quote, "Fail better," above my desk.
It's in the book, too.
Oh, good. Yeah, I threw away like two batches of like 500 pages. I threw this book away twice. And I had such a sense of failure as I wrote it, and the tones being wrong, everything being wrong. And I thought, you know, if I put all these good quotes in there, maybe there'll be somebody who'll find these great books to read, because I really tried to select from writers who had saved my life, who had illuminated me or made me feel less lonely. So even though some of the quotes I think are extremely bleak, I think when you're in a bleak mind frame, it's comforting to know other people have felt that way.
Absolutely.
And survived. Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, you said you wrote this book, what, two or three times, and you kept throwing it away?
Three times.
So was this one harder to write than the others?
It was so horrible.
Why was it harder?
Because I'm the one being culpable, because I'm writing about my son's father.
Mm-hmm.
You know, initially I wrote it and he was a complete angel and I was a wretch. It's not that the events changed, but just tonally or the slant. And that's what I mean about memoir as opposed to video, giving the inner life of a book. And so I threw that away in August of 08, and then January of 09, I threw away another 500 pages, in which he was all evil and I was all good. Oh, also, the other reason I threw it away, I've been encouraged to write about my prayer, like the actual practice of what I did, which, I mean, I pray a lot compared to secular people, but compared to people who actually know about prayer, I'm a total neophyte. So, you know, I put in all this stuff and I, you know, it was so tedious. Oh, my God. They wanted some instruction book or something. And so I threw that away, and I threw away all the stuff about Warren Whitbread and my marriage. And it was January of 09, and I was inconsolable because I had no idea how to start over. I was weeping. I walked around my bathrobe for 3 days and called out for Curry and made obscene gestures at the rafters. And there are a couple of people I call at such times. Sort of the way you would call, the president would call the push the red button, I call these people. So I called Don DeLillo, and DeLillo sends me a postcard that says, write or die. And I think I sent him one back that said, write and die with the and underline. And then I also called Robert Haas, who was my teacher, a poet who's poet laureate in Berkeley, teaches at Berkeley. I called Bob And I was weeping. I think I was weeping and really feeling sorry for myself and really without faith of any kind. And I said to Bob, you know, I'm afraid that I've written a really bad book. I'm going to write a bad book. Bad. And he said, well, you know, if it's bad, you'll write a book that has some good sentences in it. And then he asked me something like what a Jesuit once asked me, what would you write if you weren't afraid in a way? Which I never really know how to answer. But Bob said, what are you afraid of losing? Are you afraid of losing your position in the community or your status? And I'm like, absolutely. Yeah, I'd like to lie and say I don't care. But yeah, sure, of course. I want people to invite me to speak places. I want to sell books, of course. But most of what I'm afraid of losing is that I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to have the conversation with other writers, that I would be sent back to the farm club dugout. I wouldn't get to talk to people like Bob Haas and Don DeLillo. Honest to God, that's mostly of what I was afraid of. So anyway, I somehow had to surrender again. It's a weird thing. It was a spiritual process for me to surrendering how the book would be received.
Just on a practical note, I'm thinking how terrified your publisher must have been when in January of this year, you were starting from scratch, more or less.
Well, that's not. I had 120 pages. Oh my God! The phone calls. My agent. I mean, people. When they give you money, Terry, you know this. When they give you money, they're extremely interested. And when the book will be done, they give you money up front, and then they stand there and they tap their foot and look at their watches and are like, "Come on."
Well, they want to publish at a certain time. It's in the catalog, probably. It's ready to be promoted. Everything's in gear, and there's got to be a book.
Right. And I'm 9 years behind the last time I did this, and they're saying, "Where's the momentum?" You know, and I'm like, "Look, if this book is meant to be read, it'll be read." Now they don't think that way. You know, they don't think that God's in charge of whether people buy my book or not. But I kind of do. You know, I know God wanted me to write this book. That doesn't mean he wants it to be a bestseller, you know. But something about surrendering a lot of that stuff, it quiets the fear in my head. It just quiets it.
Now, you've said that your son has not read your memoirs.
No.
A lot of other people have.
So isn't that lucky for me?
I doubt it's a lack of curiosity because he sounds from what you write about him like he's a really smart, curious person who's also interested in documentary form and has done his own share of documenting his world with video. So is it an act of like self-protection, do you think, to not read it? Or is he protecting you from his judgment of your book? Or what do you think?
You know, I think he knows all the stories in all the books. I never wanted him to hear something from someone else. So, for instance, he didn't read Liars Club because I'm sexually assaulted in it. And I think it would have been it's one thing to know your mother was sexually assaulted as a child. It's another thing to read it described. Same thing with Cherry. I said to him, you know, in this book, I'm dating my high school boyfriend, and we have sex. And that's one of the things that happens in the book. I didn't want his friends to say, your mother had sex with her high school boyfriend. And he said, yeah, I figured as much. I'm not an idiot. So this book, of course, he was alive for a lot of this book. And he's heard many of these stories. So I think he wants to experience my history from me, not as a work of art. He knows the degree to which, for me, these things are works of art. However, I think one reason I wrote this book is to explain to him the inner machinations in my head when I was being an incredible pain, I'm sure, in his, 2.5-year-old butt. But I think he knows the story. So I think when he's older, he'll read the books. He still sells them.
He still sells them?
He gets his friends to buy them all the time, yeah. You should buy my mom's books. They're real great.
So he wants them reading about your sex life and them reading about you being sexually abused?
No. I think he has a sense that I'm respected for what I do. I think he has a sense of respect for what I do.
Right.
I think it's actually
to be proud of. I mean, anyone who has a mother who writes like you should want their friends to read it.
Well, there you go. But yeah, he's a young filmmaker. He's curious. He said in high school, I don't want to read these books until I'm older. And I said, that makes sense.
Mary Carr, her new memoir is called Lit. These are hard times for fish lovers and for fish. Yesterday on our show, marine ecologist Daniel Pauly warned us about how industrial fishing, with the help of trawls as large as 6 jumbo jets, is depleting stocks of fish and changing the ecosystems of the oceans. As areas get fished out, industry boats move to deeper waters and more remote areas. Pauly says we're now at the last frontier of fishing, although not all experts are as pessimistic. Today we're going to hear his suggestions about what fish to eat, which fish have the highest mercury content, and what about farmed fish? Pauly is a professor at the Fishery Center of the University of British Columbia and principal investigator of its Sea Around Us project. Let's start with his suggestions about how to prevent more fish stock from being depleted. He opposes subsidizing fisheries because, in his opinion, this can be an incentive to continue overfishing. And he supports creating areas where the stock can recover and replenish themselves, marine protected areas or sanctuaries.
The U.S. actually is doing this. In California, there is a system of marine protected areas. Parts of Alaska also are not going to be exploited. And so that is very positive measures. And in Hawaii, the northwestern Hawaiian island, their stocks of fish can recover and repopulate the areas that are being fished. The scientists tell you how much can be fished in a certain area. Listen to them. In most fisheries, once the scientists have said 10,000 tons can be fished there, the politicians say, oh, we have to have 20,000 tons exploited because of social consideration. And this results in 1 year or 2 years of happiness, so to say. But after that, the stock goes. And then it costs even more to maintain the fisheries that are being helped that way.
I love fish, and you're painting a very grim picture of our fish future. Let's talk about eating fish. You complain in your article that we continue to eat fish as if it were a sustainable practice. And you say eating a tuna roll at a sushi restaurant should be considered no more environmentally benign than driving a Hummer or harpooning a manatee. So are you saying we shouldn't be eating fish, or we shouldn't be eating certain fish, or shouldn't be eating as much fish?
There is a big debate about that. And I'm not sure what I should answer. Because on one hand, I very much sympathize with the notion that we should regulate our consumption to reflect our values. That's one thing. On the other hand, no fishery has ever been managed based on consumption patterns. They get reasonably managed when the government intervenes and say, you should catch so much, and we're going to have a surveillance program. We're going to have an observer on board to make sure that you do the things that you said you would do. Without compliance and surveillance, program, you cannot regulate fisheries. And I have problems linking the good intention of consumers with the surveillance programs.
So in other words, good intentions of consumers, if I eat less fish, it's not going to stop the fisheries from continuing to fish out.
That's the question fish. I have. This is like I separate the paper from other garbage and I do all the good things and I drive a Prius, but I don't fool myself that this is going to, it's my contribution to global warming. This is a big problem. It can be addressed by big powers, and a big power is the government. I think that we must act as citizens and not only as consumers.
As consumers, I'll speak about myself here. I mean, I eat a lot of fish, and I love like salmon and flounder and tilapia.
So do I.
Yeah, catfish is really good. And do you prefer, as a consumer yourself, choosing one fish over another because of your knowledge of which fish are depleted?
Certainly. Mm-hmm. I live in British Columbia, and I eat wild-caught salmon as opposed to farm salmon. And
can I stop you there? Why is that? You know, I go to the store and I always figure, like, farmed salmon, well, they're not going to run out because they're not going to be depleted because they're farmed. I mean, they're just restocking the supply and, you know.
Yeah, but to produce one pound of salmon, you need 3 pounds of other fish that are ground up and fed to them. The food that they eat is made out of other fish that are ground up. And these fish are perfectly edible. They are anchovies, sardine, herrings, and mackerels, and so on, that are caught elsewhere. That's the first reason that people are not aware about farming. Fish farming cannot produce fish when it produces the equivalent of lions that need to be fed gazelles to produce the bodies. Fish farming is not producing fish. It's consuming fish. At least when it is the farming of carnivorous fish, or fish that eat other fish. On the other hand, when you eat a catfish, catfish are fed soy meal. Soy meal is a vegetable matter, and you end up with a net fish production, but not with salmon.
So farmed catfish, are eating that is better environmentally? Because you're killing fewer fish.
Yep.
What about tilapia?
Tilapia are herbivorous animals also. They consume algae, and to the extent that they're not fed with fish meal, as sometimes happens, tilapia are environmentally very friendly.
What other fish are environmentally friendly?
Mussels. If you will count the shellfish, all bivalves, all oysters, mussels, clams, and so on, are feeding at the bottom of the food web. They are good things.
Do you think about mercury when you eat fish?
Now, mercury comes from the consumption of fish on the top of food web, carnivores. And carnivores enrich the pollutants that accumulate in the bodies of their prey. And they are the worst accumulators of nasties that dioxin, and PCBs and mercury is one of them. And a dish like sushi or sashimi that in Japan was a festive dish that you ate from time to time has become something that some people eat regularly, even daily. And that is high risk, especially for pregnant women, for example.
Health-wise, are we better off eating smaller fish?
Yeah, certainly. The anchovies, for example, they are very tasty and they don't bioaccumulate the pollutant that we talked about. So both in terms of taste and in terms of health, eating small fish is better for you.
What other small fish should we be thinking about?
Well, herring, sardine, anchovies, for example. In fact, in Europe, if you go as a tourist or to Germany, you will have Matthias herring in various forms. Or in Spain and Portugal, you will have all kind of sardine. And these fish are excellent.
When you eat sardines, are they in a can or are they fresh?
They can be in a can. They can be fresh. They can be grilled. In Spain, they eat a lot of grilled sardine.
Daniel Pauly, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Daniel Pauly is a professor at the Fishery Center of the University of British Columbia and principal investigator of its Sea Around Us project. Social activist and best-selling author Barbara Kingsolver's books include The Bean Trees, Pigs in Heaven, The Poisonwood Bible, and Animal Vegetable Miracle. Kingsolver's long-awaited new novel is called The Lacuna. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
The Lacuna is Barbara Kingsolver's first new novel in 9 years. Interest in it is unusually fierce for a work of literary fiction. Last month, the news broke that Walmart, Amazon, and Target are engaged in a price war against booksellers over the hot late fall, early winter releases. All but one of the blockbuster books in question are works of genre fiction, suspense and horror stories by the likes of James Patterson, Stephen King, Dean Koontz, and John Grisham. The Lacuna is the only literary novel caught in the crosshairs of this sales skirmish. Kingsolver deserves kudos, if only because she seems to be single-handedly keeping consumer zest alive for the literary novel. I wish I could say she also deserves kudos for writing a spectacular work of fiction, but to tell you the truth, it's just, at best, so-so. In fact, as a piece of historical fiction, it has a lot in common with those conventional works of genre fiction that Amazon and the big box stores are hawking at those bargain prices. A serious problem with The Lacuna is telegraphed in its striking title. Lacuna refers to a gap or something that's absent. The motif of the crucial missing piece runs throughout the novel, but the thing unintentionally missing here is an engaging main character. Our hero, Harrison Shepard, is an accidental onlooker to history, buffeted by other people's plans and passions. As he tells a friend late in the novel, what we end up calling history is a kind of knife slicing down through time. A few people are hard enough to bend its edge, but most people won't even stand close to the blade. I'm one of those. I don't bend anything. The passive Harrison was born in the U.S. to a dim American father and a firecracker of a Mexican mother who's eternally on the prowl for a richer husband. In 1929, when Harrison is 12 years old, his mother snags a big Mexican landowner and she takes her son to live on her lover's estate. Adrift, Harrison spends his days swimming and learning how to cook from the kitchen staff. When he runs into the artist Frida Kahlo at the local market, Harrison goes home with her and puts his dough-rolling skills to use by mixing plaster for Kahlo's husband, the muralist Diego Rivera. Eventually, Lev Leon Trotsky moves into the household, and Harrison becomes his secretary as well as a witness to Trotsky's assassination by one of Stalin's agents. Later, as a young adult living back in the States, Harrison is targeted by the House Committee on Un-American Activities because of his past association with revolutionaries. Throughout all the artistic, political, and erotic turmoil swirling through the Kahlo Rivera household, Harrison has kept a diary, which is published posthumously and composes the novel we're reading. Kingsolver's aim here, clearly, is to give us the bystander view of history, the perspective of the ordinary Joe rather than the key players. As Frida Kahlo declares to the young Harrison, greatness is very boring. The politically incorrect truth is, however, that ordinariness oftentimes is even more boring. Harrison is so pallid, so retiring, that it's very hard to stay for extended periods in his company, and seeing history unfold from his wan point of view isn't all that illuminating. neither are the actual newspaper accounts of Trotsky's assassination and the Red Scare that Kingsolver includes here. Accounts that break the, by now, not so startling news that official history contains lies. When masters of postmodern historical fiction like E.L. Doctorow or Don DeLillo or even arguably Toni Morrison shake up received narratives about the past, it's with the intention of making readers see something fresh, something larger, even mythic, in familiar events. Kingsolver stops short of that ambition and instead swerves off in an old-fashioned, sentimental direction, inviting readers to feel affection for the Zelig-like Harrison and a life not quite lived. I admit it, I'm mystified. To me, The Lacuna is an all-too-appropriate title for a novel that just feels altogether vacant.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Lacuna by Barbara Kingsolver.